It's sad when a mother has to speak the words that condemn her own son. But I couldn't allow them to believe that I would commit murder. They'll put him away now, as I should have years ago. He was always bad. And in the end, he intended to tell them I killed those girls and that man. As if I could do anything except just sit and stare, like one of his stuffed birds. Well, they know I can't even move a finger, and I won't. I'll just sit here and be quiet, just in case they do suspect me. They're probably watching me. Well, let them. Let them see what kind of a person I am. I'm not even going to swat that fly. I hope they are watching. They'll see. They'll see and they'll know. And they'll say, why, she wouldn't even harm a fly.
Yeah, just sit in that padded cell and not even swat a fly. Terrible Tommy here in the bunker right here in north central Indiana. On a very cool day. It's in the 20s today. High 20s. Whoa, baby. We're supposed to get some snow in here for 2 or 3 days coming up, starting later this week. So batten down the hatches, boys. Yeah. Get all those real expensive weapons of mass destruction covered up with canvas. We don't want them to be all screwed up and not be able to be used when we sell them in the spring. That's right. Got to get out of that Tommy's Terrible Tavern once in a while and do some work. Yeah. We're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. And that's where you send your donations for the radio show, and I'm happy to say that several of you sent them in yesterday, got them at the post office. They said, hey, what you doing there, man? That's a lot of mail in that P.O. Box of yours. I said, well, we got some good buddies out there. First thing I do when I move to a new area, which is not very often, but I always make friends with the post office people. I've always gotten along great with them, and they take care of me. Yeah, they sure do. Yeah, I always ask them when they're going to get a raise, because they deserve a raise. Yeah, because the post office is the only institution in this country that makes money, but they keep taking their money and putting it into other things, man. So I support those letter carriers, man. That's the best socialist program we've got. You know, I was rummaging around in this bunker of mine, and I came up with a tape. Don't have a date on it, but I think it was in the 70s, early 70s. And the Jews had burned down the IHR warehouse with all their books, and we were hot on the trail of Mordecai Levy because we thought he was a prime suspect, the head of the JDO in New York. But he wasn't in New York then. He was operating out of L.A. He was a snivelly little Jew. Yeah. But we were on his trail. Yeah. So I'm going to play you back a few things, and this is where it's got to go way back, because I was working trying to help Willis Cardo with his problems. I think he liked it because I did it free. He didn't have to pay me. Willis didn't like to spend any money. Okay, I'm going to play this, and you can hear what happened way back in the early 70s when we're tracking down who we thought had quite a bit to do with the firebombing and the arson at the IHR warehouse.
Playing basketball with the telephone?
Sorry. Mom,
it's
for you.
It's time. Is your mother around?
Yeah, I think she's on the other end. Yeah, like an old toilet seat. Oh.
Nancy, I need a little, we're updating our people in the east because there's some fairly heavy things coming down.
Yeah.
I need to know as much as I can about was there any report given to federal authorities on this thing the other day at the office?
Federal authorities? Well, only the police, as far as I know.
Oh, shit.
Why?
Well, Ricardo should know enough to report this stuff to ATF and make a file a thing on it. Uh-huh. And
where is ATF?
Where are they? They're all over the place. They're probably watching you right now.
He called someplace up in Palos Verdes. Tom did to report something.
Mm-hmm.
It was different other than, in other words...
Well, what I need to do is, I tried to call him, but Carter wasn't home. But what I'm getting at is that we need to know as soon as possible whether there's whether this explosive device or whatever it was actually filed with ATF or FBI. That it happened because we're hot on a trail of Levy.
Oh, boy. He just called me.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, bragging about the Toronto fire again.
Did you detect it was a local call?
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. That's good. What time did he call?
Got your list today.
Okay, good. And he called you what time?
7:15.
That's great because that helps. Yeah, we got a lot of very intricate things going on right now.
We're going to surveil this place and see if we can't come up with his license number.
Well, that's good.
Not with our own cars.
Yeah, that's good. We need as much of that kind of information as we can.
Yeah, in fact, we're going out later on.
Yeah, and I've got another plate I have to run. But this is all going into a bigger deal, and so every little thing that happens, update me as fast as possible, because...
Okay, well, I was going to call you, but we haven't had dinner. I was going to call you right after dinner to let you know about this.
Yeah, okay, fine. That's great.
One thing that really upsets them is the fact that we know he's been in prison.
Also, hit him with his mother being...
Oh, I have, and that got to him.
Mm-hmm.
That really got to him.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I got such a clear voice on him that there's going to be no way. I told him we had a $10,000 reward out for him.
What's important? Oh, yeah? I'll take it. No.
Yeah.
What's
said, well, who's putting it up? That really upset him, too.
Yeah.
Well, you know everything about me. You got a file. Why should I tell you?
Yeah.
You have your ADL put out their money and find out who's put up the reward.
What's very important is not so much what he says as that he's still in California at 7:15 p.m.
Definitely. Okay. Breaks about having dual citizenship, though, so I imagine he's probably getting ready to run.
Well, we're very interested. The elections in Israel are very important because if Begin wins Kahani
yeah.
is going to be arriving in the next couple of days in New York.
Uh-huh.
And the word we've got is he's going to take some people back for some more intense training.
About it.
So anyhow, I'll make a call now. That's very good information, and anything comes up, I'll let me know.
Very, very clear tapes I have on him, so I know that they're local.
Okay, fine.
They're just like they're coming from the next room.
Yeah, you can always tell a long distance, at least here, you get that clink type thing, that sort of, not a tone, but a clink.
Yeah, I told him we had a reward for an insane telephone terrorist by the name of James Gutman.
Yes, right.
Well, there's just more of your men that we'll knock off when we find them putting up the posters all over town.
Mm-hmm.
I told him they're going up all over the place. And he's really concerned about who's put up this money. He thought I was serious.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. Keep him thinking that.
He's paranoid as hell.
Keep him thinking that.
Well, I knew he was going to call tonight.
They keep screwing with the Iraqis. There'll be plenty of money. Don't worry about it.
Right.
Okay?
Yeah.
All right, fine. Well...
do what we can. I'm not in contact with anyone over there until Monday morning, so I'll find out what I can then.
Well, I'll try to call Willis later on this evening.
He went out of town. Now he should be back.
Okay. Well, I'll call a little later.
So we'll see you.
But that's very important information, the 7:15 call. That's more important than anything right now, so I'll have to call some people.
Oh, yeah, he's probably right around the corner here.
Okay, fine.
Okay.
Great, Nancy. Thanks.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Again.
Yeah.
I forgot to call United, and there is a United flight out at 9:40, and it's 263 also. Those are the only two, though, with that kind of rate.
Yeah, okay.
The only two out of all the airlines, so I've called all of them. That's it. There's only two American and United.
Is that one way?
Yeah.
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 Okay.
No, all the others are 300 and on up.
Mm-hmm.
All the others. TSA doesn't go out. Not to New York.
Yeah.
They do go Pan Am goes to Chicago first. They stop off in Chicago, and then they have to take another transfer on to Kennedy.
Yeah.
They seem to call from Chicago quite a bit.
Yeah. Okay, fine. Well, that's good. I'll...
The guys are still out, so maybe something's going on. I don't know.
Yeah. No, that's a, it's too bad they don't have a CB.
Oh, yeah. Well, Rob's going to have one installed, but he never did. He said he, you know, would have one put in the camper.
I'll tell him to get one in.
Well, I was, that's what he said, that he has it out
there. I'll tell him.
Anyhow.
Just tell him to do it.
Yeah,
well, I mean, what the hell? He's single. I mean, you know.
He can afford it, I'm sure.
He can support it. You can buy him and even use it at Thrifty's in the paper for $25,
yeah.
$30, so.
Well, we don't even have one. I can't demand him to get one.
Well.
No money, you know. Money.
Have him get two.
Yeah.
Sure. Okay.
Sure, Mr. Smart.
Okay, I'll talk to you.
If I find anything, I'll call you back.
Okay, fine, yeah. Nancy. Bye.
Boy, that was a long time ago, and it had to do with that bombing or arsoning of the IHR in Los Angeles. And this she-wolf of ours was working for Carto in that outfit, but she also was working for us. And we worried more about that firebombing than Carto did. I guess he collected a lot of insurance or something. But before I started running the Klan in California, routinely these right-wing conservatives would have these meetings with speakers and stuff, and routinely they'd be invaded by the Jewish Defense League or even the Jewish Defense Organization later on. They'd beat up people and tear up the place and everything else. Or their favorite tactic was just to call the owners of the restaurant or the hotel where the meeting was and scare the shit out of them, and then they wouldn't allow the right-wing conservatives to meet there. James K. Warner used to have the New Christian Crusade Church, which was about the most anti-Jew outfit in the country. And they routinely try to invade their meetings until we came along. And I had some pretty tough boys. And I remember one time they had this meeting at a big hotel in the San Fernando Valley, as I recall. And here come the JDF, Jewish Defense League. And we chased them out of the place, and... I remember one friend of mine, good buddy, tough as nails, he chased Irv Rubin for three blocks, and it was funny because his eyesight wasn't too good, and Irv Rubin initially yelled something at him, and he couldn't discern it was Irv Rubin, and he turned around to step forward just to ask him, what he was saying, and Irv Rubin took off running across the four-lane highway, almost got run over by cars and trucks. At the time, this fellow we're talking about on the telephone, Mordecai Levy, he was actually from New York, but he was going to school out here in L.A., and he was trying to harass our people, getting their phone numbers and crank-calling them and everything. And we were following him around. And then also there was Irv Rubin and his Jewish Defense League. And, of course, Mordecai Levy was connected with them originally, but then they had a split. And that split came, it got pretty hairy. Mordecai lived there in New York City. I forget the name of that very well-known street, and he lived at the top of this building. And Irv Rubin took his lawyer from California, went back there to serve papers on Levy. They were fighting among themselves. Mordecai Levy opens up the window on his third or fourth floor apartment with an M16 or AK-47, I don't remember which. It started blasting down into the street. And they hit some poor guy who was a carpenter or something, or a plumber, sitting in his truck, pickup truck, eating his sandwich, and they got him. Luckily, it didn't kill him. So anyhow, he didn't get much out of that, Mordecai Levy. He got some time, but not too bad. He got involved in a lot of stuff. He was going around New York City with a trunk full of weapons, and he was staying at this one motel. Something happened. He burnt the motel down accidentally, and then the cops caught him with a trunk full of weapons, and he did some more time for that, but not the kind of time our guys do, I'll tell you that. Irv Rubin's another story. We confronted him around, you know, like some of the L.A. Nazis beat him up a couple of times, too. But anyhow, we were able to find out where his money was coming in from, and we do know that most of the money for the ADL and so forth was coming out of Canada from B'nai B'rith. And one of our guys that was working in the stock market got his numbers, Irv Rubin's file numbers, his account numbers. We knew exactly how much money he had in his account at any one time. And they never did find out. We knew all that stuff. Well, there was... I think we're pretty sure Rubin burned down this Arab church, not Arab church, Arab restaurant up in the Jew section there of Los Angeles. Got to understand that the old section, and the name escapes me at the moment, was where the older Jews were still hanging on, the ones that didn't have much money. The more wealthy Jews had already moved out into the valley and into the Hollywood Hills and you name it. But anyhow, they burnt down this Arab restaurant. And we furnished the owners with the information that Irv Rubin's account a day after the arson on that restaurant, he deposited about $5,000 to his account. So anyhow, we knew all that, so anyhow. Those were the days, and we did a lot of intelligence investigating. We never got much thanks from the right-wing conservatives. That's why you hear me bad-mouthing them all the time. Carter was one of the worst. He was cheap. He wouldn't pay people for services that they were risking their lives for. All that kind of stuff, so... I'll probably remember some more stories as time goes on. I remember one story I told before, but been a long time since I've told it. We knew where Irv Rubin lived, and I and a couple of my guys went out there one day and sat down the street from his house or his apartment. We could see Irv Rubin in the back in the parking lot with his son, Ari, washing a car. And so I snuck up and put our literature all over his front door. And we went back out there a few weeks later, and there were cameras everywhere. He really beefed up his security. But we walked right up there in broad daylight and plastered Klan literature all over his front door. Which was to let him know that it could have been a lot worse, or you were right there in plain sight. Another little sidelight, Sherry, Irv Rubin's wife, her parents hated Irv Rubin with a passion. They hated him terribly. Well, anyhow, she got a nose job from a plastic surgeon, so she changed herself to look like an Aryan. And so whenever I debate him on TV, I say, "How's that Aryan nose job your wife got?" He'd go crazy. I said, "What? Aren't you proud? Isn't your wife proud of being a Jew? I mean, so you know, she goes out and gets an Aryan nose job. How much did you pay for that? Well, I found out they paid about $2,500, $3,000 for that nose job. But today, it'd probably be $10,000. But, of course, Irv Rubin had connections to the Jew mob. And there was a lot of retired Israeli military people in L.A. and were sure that some of this arson and stuff was perpetrated by those people. And then they killed the Palestinian down there in L.A. too, in South L.A. Forgot his name too. Anyhow, they walked up and put a bomb on the front door and killed him. Alex O'Day, yeah, that was his name, yeah. They finally found out who did it, and they were connected with the Jewish Defense League, and they fled to Israel, as a lot of these killers do. But they finally got him back and tried him. No, Irv Rubin's wife, her name was Shelley, not Sherry, and so to get that straight. After Irv Rubin took a dive off the second or third tier of the jail downtown, the federal lockup, which they called suicide, I knew it wasn't suicide. Shelley, she knew it wasn't suicide, but she never could get it investigated properly. But they covered that up, and he obviously did not commit suicide. He was surrounded by black power guys and white power guys and Nazis and Hell's Angels and everybody else that in there. So I don't know which one did it, but somebody did it. But I can say one thing about Irv Rubin. He wasn't a suicide type guy. He'd stand up pretty strong in the streets. He lost a lot of times, got his nose broke a couple of times, but he was a stand up. There's only one person of the conservative right-wing racist cause that ever did anything really right when it came to being invaded, their meetings being invaded by Irv Rubin and the boys. And that was a little old lady who was taking care of the coffee. And she took a whole pitcher full of hot water, I mean steaming hot water, and dumped it on the head of a JDL guy, and he ran out of the room screaming like a baby. So that was the bravest woman in the right wing at the time. But these right wingers never have security, proper security to meetings. Duke was that way too. He didn't think that was a very good idea for him. It might give him bad publicity. There was a meeting by these right-wing conservative racial people over in Illinois a few years ago, and they didn't have any security, and in comes the Reds, commies, whatever they are, progressives, tore the place up, knifed a couple of people, and got out of there. But the right-wing conservatives have hardly ever been serious about this kind of stuff. They think they can put on their suit and tie and go down to a regular meeting hall and not be harassed or not being attacked. Well, those days were gone decades ago. Here's another one. I've told it several times. They probably get tired of hearing it, but Duke used to have a meeting usually once a year and bring them all in. I guess they still do that. Well, I and Louis Beam went to this thing and acted as security. We had all our equipment and everything, and so here's the meeting going on, and Duke's giving his speech. Incidentally, he got up on the stage and was showing people how to lift weights. I looked at Louis, Louis looked at me, and we... Oh, man, it was funny. But anyhow, we had scanners and everything, and we picked up a bug in the room, in the crowd, in the hall. And it was a woman cop, or a woman fed or something. So I told Duke, we're going to stop this meeting right now, and we're going to strip search everybody in the goddamn place till we find who it is. Oh, no, you can't. Oh, no, couldn't do that. Don't do that. We can't do that. And He said, the women too? I said, hell yes, the women too. It is a woman that's got the bug on. Oh, no, we can't do that. We can't do that. And I said, this is ridiculous. Lewis Beam, after that, left the Klan, left Duke, because it was you can't do security for people like that, because they don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. Well, I don't give a fuck whose feelings are hurt. We wanted to find out who that was and make them look bad in the press, get their picture and all that kind of stuff. You cannot win a war playing games. You've got to be serious. That's one of the reasons you won't see me at any of these coffee clutches anymore. They have them around the country. I won't go to them. You're not safe going to these things. You're absolutely vulnerable to about anything, not just from the feds infiltrating, but your enemies and people who will kill you if they get a chance. So I quit going to these confabs, and some guys get a little upset with me. They want me to come and speak. I said, I'm not coming to speak because you don't know how to secure your people. Well, I'm going to finish out the rest of the show with our book from Statecraft that we've been reading on, and I hope you like it. Now we're going back to Nuremberg, and I'll read the last paragraph of what I read yesterday. One of the capital mistakes committed by the Allies at Nuremberg was to equate the Wehrmacht with the Nazi Party and thus render the German generals responsible for the exhortations and wrongs of the regime. In fact, there was always existing a fundamental antagonism between the Wehrmacht leaders and the Nazi Party. The German generals, who had been schooled in the traditional discipline of the old Imperial Army, regarded Hitler as a low-class upstart and reproached him for lowering the political morality to the level of gangsterism and discrediting Germany in the eyes of civilized nations. I know there's some of the people out there that don't like to hear that kind of stuff. Hitler, who felt that they secretly despised him, hated the distrust and distrusted his generals, especially when they belonged to the old German military aristocracy. But he could not dispense with them, and hence by his anger, which at times gave vent to outbursts of uncontrolled fury. Well, he didn't have his generals behind him when he was really needed them, because he just didn't depend on them, which was a fatal mistake. This antagonism increased in proportion to the situation worsened on all fronts, and when it became evident that Hitler's presence at the head of the government was leading Germany to catastrophe, there was only one solution: to get rid of Hitler. Unfortunately, however, obedience and discipline are second nature in the German army, and only a desperate situation would urge the generals to open rebellion. Besides, public opinion in Germany would have to be taken into account if it was to succeed, but the public, intoxicated by Goebbels' propaganda, completely misunderstood the situation and blindly trusted in its Führer. On top of that, one has to take into account Roosevelt's pro-Soviet policy, the Morgenthau Plan, which was to wipe out everybody in Germany, Germany's total and unconditional surrender, and the surrender of half of Europe to the Soviets, a crazy policy from the European point of view, which made the whole situation even more complicated, since the German generals were patriots, and they were not prepared to sacrifice Hitler merely in order to hand over Germany's bound hand and foot into the Soviet tyranny. It was a formidable situation to be resolved. Several attempts to assassinate Hitler failed at the last moment, owing to unforeseen circumstances. On 20 July 1944, Hitler had a miraculous escape. Following this attempt, a great number of officers and politicians were massacred, including some of the most famous leaders of the German army. Colonel Count von Stauffenberg, a war hero of the Afrika Korps, who was covered with wounds and who had been the mainspring of the plot, and Marshals Rommel, von Wilsbin and von Kluge, Admiral Canaris, General von Skupnagel, and others. Now, Admiral Canaris was proved to be a traitor. I mean, a real traitor early on. He'd been in the employ of, I think it was the Soviets. It cannot be denied that on Hitler's express orders, the war in the East was conducted with an extreme savagery for which the German army was not responsible. The German generals had always protested against such barbaric methods of warfare, but Hitler took not the slightest note of them. The English writer John W. Wheeler Bennett has clearly described the reaction of the German army's leaders to these barbarous orders in his book, The Drama of the German Army. Quote, quite a few of the generals who had campaigned in Poland were shattered by what they've seen. These men were normally able to withstand the horrors of war, but they were not prepared for the abominations endangered by the Nazi ideology. When they had heard their Führer speaking of extermination at Old Salzburg on 22nd August, they imagined that he was being carried away by the force of oratory and by his imagination. When he had said, our strength lies in the absence of all pity and in violence, and when he had spoken of mercilessly killing everyone of the Polish race and tongue, men, women, and children, they little imagined that they were supposed to take these proposals literally, forgetting that except when he had given his word, Hitler always thought what he spoke. Quote, it wasn't long before they discovered the terrible truth. The Polish campaign had only been launched 2 weeks, and victory was already in sight. When Ribbentrop informed Keitel on the headquarters train on 12 September of the Führer's instruction in dealing with the Polish question, these instructions included massive executions among all members of the intelligentsia, the nobility, and the clergy. In other words, among all the classes capable of providing future leaders in the event of a resistance movement and general massacre of the Jews. Keitel transmitted these instructions to Canaris, who was absolutely confounded. The little admiral replied that such a thing was possible, impossible, and that the German military honor would be stained for all eternity if he were to allow such horrors to take place. But Keitel replied that the Führer had ordered that those measures should be carried out, and furthermore, he had added that they were not to the army's liking. The army would have to accept an equal number of SS and SIPO security police units who would carry out the Führer's orders independently of military authorities. This is, in fact, what happened 1 month later. Under these conditions, the armed forces of the Reich had no choice but to obey the orders of their supreme commander. A day will come, Canaris told Keitel, with prophetic accuracy, when the world will hold a Wehrmacht under whose eyes these things have been allowed to happen responsible for these atrocious measures. The same methods were applied even more strenuously against the Russians, and it is virtually certain that the policy cost Hitler the war, since at the beginning the German troops were frequently greeted as liberators from the Bolshevik tyranny, but Hitler was not waging war against Bolshevism, but against the Russian nation. And against the Slav race, which was the greatest assistance to Stalin, whose regime, tottering on the edge of defeat, was thus consolidated. Hitler was massacring national elites in the name of the superior race, and Stalin was doing the same on his side in the name of revolutionary morality, which demanded the annihilation of social classes that could not be assimilated by Marxism. The war which this state of affairs produced attained apocalyptic depths of horror, but once again it was the party and not the army which bore the responsibility. And that's a lot like in this country, you know. The politicians created the conditions for, like, Vietnam and so forth. not the Army. Among the Nuremberg files is a document of capital importance. It is a secret report which sent to Alfred Rosenberg by Dr. Vautigan. On 24 October 42, Rosenberg was the Nazi minister in charge of the administration of occupied territory in the East, and Dr. Vautigan was political advisor to Marshals List and Kleist, who were in command of the army on the Caucasian front. In his report, Vautigan sets out with great clarity the extraordinary frankness and main mistakes in Hitler's policy towards the Russian people. He does not hide the fact that such a savage attitude could cost Germany the war. In fact, this is precisely what happened. Here are the essential passages from the report. I might interject that they were doing great under the peace pact between Germany and Russia. And if they'd have kept it, Hitler would have been seen as a savior of Western civilization, probably. But when he turned on Russia, and Russia lost, what, 20 million, 30 million people? Mostly white people. Quote, when we entered the Soviet territory, we found people exhausted by Bolshevism and desperately awaiting a new ideology which would bring them the hope of a better future, which National Socialism would have done. Germany's duty was to provide them with the ideology, but this was not done. The people greeted us with joys as liberators and willingly put themselves in our hands. Quote, but with the natural instinct of Eastern people, they soon discovered that for Germany the slogan liberation from Bolshevism was simply a pretext to reduce them to a new slavery. Peasants and working men soon understood that Germany did not regard them as partners possessing equal rights, but simply as an object of their own political and economic ideals. With unquelled presumption, we treat the people of occupied Eastern territories as second-class whites, whom Providence had assigned to Germany alone as her slaves. It is no secret that our Russian prisoners died of hunger and cold by the hundreds of thousands. As a result, we are now in an absurd position of having to recruit millions of workmen in the occupied territories of the East, having allowed thousands of prisoners of war to die of hunger like flies. With the fathomless scorn of the prevailing Slav mentality, methods of recruiting were employed whose origins doubtless go back to the darkest periods of the slave trade. A veritable manhunting campaign was instigated. Without any consideration for their age or their physical condition, the people were sent into Germany. Our policy forced both the Bolsheviks and the Russian nationalists to combine against us, and today Russia is fighting with a courage and an exceptional spirit of sacrifice simply in order that its human dignity should be recognized, unquote. Naturally, this report was completely ignored. Hitler, Rosenberg, and Himmler, who were all in favor of adopting a tough line vis-a-vis on the Slavs, would not hear of it. Goebbels was indeed aware of the errors being committed, but he was powerless against the other three. The generals of the Wehrmacht reacted as best they could, but Hitler forbade them to interfere in politics, and they had all their time taken up in conducting the war without being concerned about other matters such as this. The historian J. D. Lonnie of his book clearly demonstrated the efforts of the Wehrmacht made to counterbalance Hitler's policy. The first reception accorded by the liberated Russian people to the Wehrmacht had been favorable, and all the heads of the army recommended a policy of collaboration. Lieutenant Colonel Galen even proposed that 200,000 Russian volunteers who wanted to serve in the German army should be armed. Galen, like Colonel Count Stauffenberg, thought that in order to conquer Russia, it was necessary to cooperate with the Russians, while on several occasions that the Führer did not want politics in the armed forces. The Russian prisoners of war were maltreated. They turned to resistance. Nevertheless, Stauffenberg and Bodegon endeavored to find a Russian de Gaulle. Marshal von Beck approved a plan of creating a liberation army of 200,000 Russian volunteers, but General Bock was dismissed in autumn 41, and his successor, Marshal von Kluge, did not dare to raise the question with the Fuhrer. In September 41, the Municipal Council of Smolensk, which had recently been set up by the Germans, had demanded permission to form a free Russian government, but Keitel's reply, which was received in November, had been a categorical refusal. Talk about stupidity. Thereafter, there was a succession of individual initiatives. Hold it. General von Schickendorf decided to form 6 Russian battalions under the command of the Cossack Kononov in order to protect the railway lines to the rear of the armies in the central group. General Schmidt, commander of the 2nd Tank Army, set up a self-governing Russian district under the leadership of a former Russian mayor, Kaminsky. Later Kaminsky, who had been made a brigade commander, formed his own army. The Reich's commissariat, on the other hand, pursued their punitive action, openly firing upon the people and provoking resistance movements. The propaganda service of the Wehrmacht, under the direction of General von Wedel, attempted to redress the balance and even considered adopting a scheme of agrarian reform. A Russian emigre, Kazantzou, was put in charge of drawing up leaflets and publishing a propaganda newspaper, but there again, Keitel blocked all these efforts. In August 1942, at the time the German armies were conquering the Caucasus, a new hope arose when General Kostring, the former military attaché at Moscow, was appointed advisor to Marshal List. Brodigan was his political advisor, and he recommended to List and his successor Kleist a certain degree of cooperation with the Russians. Rosenberg had promised Brodigan that labor forces would not be conscripted for work in Germany from the Caucasians, and that the rapid dissolution of the Kolkhozes was envisioned. Accordingly, Kostring and Brodigan were well received in the Caucasus and even witnessed extraordinary joyful liberation celebrations. But after the defeat at Stalingrad, the Caucasian collaborators were compelled to flee, and they sought permission to join with the German army in its retreat. This was granted to Brodigan by Marshal Kleist, but many who believed in the German's word were nevertheless abandoned. Quote, the whole of this operation is revealing a flagrant contradiction which exists between certain of the Fuhrer's directives. On one hand, there was Rosenberg carrying out a punitive policy by means of unscrupulous Gauleiters, and on the other hand, Goebbels, the political idealist, was promising a better future. These deceiving claims, which were shown up every day by the facts of the occupation, certainly contributed to reuniting the Russian people against the invader. Psychologically, Germany's action in the East was a total failure, and the Fuhrer alone bears the blame for this. However, the Wehrmacht succeeded in reconstituting the Lazov army, which had a considerable strength, but Hitler, who was extremely suspicious of this initiative, fanatically opposed its entry into the war, and as a result, it remained virtually inactive up to the end. The Americans handed over the leaders of the Lasov army to the Russians, who hanged them and sent their soldiers into labor and concentration camps. While still on this subject, let us quote Admiral Dönitz's reaction as the commander-in-chief of the Navy and Hitler's successor designate when he discovered the existence of Hitler's concentration camps. On 7 May, Friedberg and Jodl returned to Murmansk. Friedberg brought with him a copy of the Stars and Stripes, an American military publication which contained some appalling photographs taken in concentration camps in Buchenwald. Doubtless the disorganization of transport and the supply of food had not served to improve the conditions in these camps in the course of the last weeks. Nevertheless, it was beyond question that nothing could justify the conditions that these photographs demonstrated. Friedberg and myself were staggered. We would never have imagined that such things were possible, but they were indeed true, and not only in Buchenwald, as we realized for ourselves when a boat transporting detainees of a concentration camp arrived in Flensburg. The eldest naval officer did everything in his power to feed and care for these unfortunate people. How could such horrors have happened in Germany without being brought to our knowledge? Now, we're not talking about just Jews in this situation, of which, of course, there weren't 6 million, that's for sure, but there were Russians, there were Czechoslovakians, there were Polish, all these people, there weren't even Jews that were in these camps. So for the guys that argue, oh, it's okay because they were just Jews, you got to understand there were thousands and thousands of non-Jews involved. Up to 1939, I had spent, remember what they were preaching, that the Slavs and all these people were low-class people. I mean, that they were Untermenschen, low-class, worthy of being killed. That's why I never could, I couldn't understand why a lot of Polish guys became American Nazis. I mean, you know, up until 1939, I had spent my whole time at sea as commander of the Emden, and then in charge of the submarines. As from the outbreak of the war, I lived mainly at my command headquarters, which were also at Singwarden in eastern Frisia, and then at Paris and Laurent. These various places were a sort of military oasis. We had little or no contact with German people. Technical problems and the conduct of submarine warfare absorbed all my time. The only information that came through to me from the enemy concerning submarines, as far as I was concerned, there was no doubt that the enemy radio was and ought to be controlled for propaganda purposes, as ours was. Accordingly, I didn't listen to either. When I was put in command of the Navy, I usually stayed at my command post, Corral, which was a lonely place between Bernau and Elberswald on the north of Berlin. When I visited general headquarters, I only took part in military conferences, and Hitler only consulted me on questions within my competence. Besides, as I have said, it was impossible to take any interest in anything else, since all my time was taken up in my work. The facts, which I learned from the inhuman side of the National Socialist regime, in the months that followed the capitulation in 1946, exerted a profound influence on me. I have set out above my attitude towards the party and my relations with Hitler. As I have said, the idea of a national community in the proper and social sense of this word, and the cohesion of the German people upon this base, fired me with enthusiasm. Hitler's reunion of all branches of the German race under one Reich seemed to me the achievement of one of the oldest dreams of our nation. Our dispersion can be traced back to the Treaty of Westphalia, which brought to an end the 30 Years' War. Our adversaries, who had achieved their own unity at the beginning of the modern era, wanted to keep us weak and to prevent us from achieving our unity for a very long time. Only National Socialism had been able to overcome all these obstacles, and accordingly it has acquired immense historical value. Quote, but it was then that I learned about its other aspects, which were definitely less attractive, and as a result, my attitude suddenly changed towards the regime which he, Hitler, had created. If only they had stuck to the original National Socialism, none of this would have happened. On 6 May, I relieved Himmler of all his functions. When I discovered all the facts relative to the concentration camps, I was sorry that I had let him off, since I was of the opinion that it was a purely German affair. You know, I have to take a break once in a while because the dogs come in through their doggy doors, and I'll tell you, I never want a two-story house again. Because they stomp around on the floor, and I don't have a lot of insulation between the bunker and the upper regions, so I have to shut it off. Anyhow, I'm going to copy all this for you once we get done with this, anyhow, so you'll be able to read it, because there's a lot of stuff in here that's mispronounced and mistakes made in reading it and so forth. Okay, back to it. Hitler's reunion of all the branches of the German race under one Reich seemed to me the achievement of one of the oldest dreams of our nation. Our dispersion can be traced back to the Treaty of Westphalia, which brought an end to the 30 Years' War. Our adversaries, who had achieved their own unity at the beginning of the modern era, wanted to keep us weak and to prevent us from achieving unity. For a long time, our National Socialism had been able to overcome all those obstacles, and accordingly it had acquired immense historical value. Well, I read that to you before. But it was then that I learnt about its other aspects, which were infinitely less attractive, and as a result my attitude suddenly changed towards the regime he, Hitler, had created. On the 6th of May, I believed Himmler of all his functions. I relieved Himmler of all his functions. When I discovered all the facts relative to the concentration camps, I was sorry that I had let him off, since I was of the opinion that it was a purely German affair, that, and we ourselves ought to bring to light all these atrocities and ourselves punish those who were guilty. Count Swearing Kostiki was of exactly the same opinion. He sent me a decree ordering a legal proceeding to be set up to inquire into these heinous crimes, and I sent a copy of the text to Eisenhower, requesting him to allow our judges every necessary facility for taking these steps. At an interview with General Murphy, the general's political advisor, I specifically brought this point to his attention and requested his support, which he promised me, but I never heard any more about the matter. That was from Grand Admiral Dönitz, 10 Years and 20 Days, a book that he authored. The Allies, who had barely understood what was happening in Germany during the war, thus committed a tragic error in equating the army with Hitler's regime. The condemnation at Nuremberg and other places of irreproachable leaders such as Dönitz, Raeder, von Kesselring, and von Manstein, or the Yamashita at Tokyo, was a perfectly iniquitous and monumental act of injustice. Göring, Keitel, and Jodl, on the other hand, could justly be considered as servile politicians who were the accomplices of and co-responsible for the acts of the party. The Allies, however, did something infinitely worse than that. Their erroneous equation of the army and with the party of Germany and the policy of terror bombing, the blindly pro-Soviet attitude of the Americans and their obstinacy in demanding global and unconditional surrender from Germany. All these factors combined to produce consequences of quite exceptional gravity. For as a result, the war was utterly needlessly prolonged for a further year, and a half. Hundreds of thousands more men were killed, and worst of all, the Soviets were able to occupy half of Europe, in which they have become solidly entrenched, representing a far greater menace for the West than ever did Nazism. Today, the Americans are paying for the politically criminal and insane policy adopted by Roosevelt at Quebec, Tehran, and Yalta, unless it can be said that he and his Jewish advisors actually intended to hand over Europe to communism, a conclusion which would seem to be justified by the famous Morgenthau documents. In his memoirs, Admiral Dönitz has clearly explained the tragic dilemma with which he found himself confronted with when he suddenly was made responsible for Germany's future as Hitler's successor designate. Quote, in January 1945, the German government entered into possession of the British instruction to Eclipse, which dealt with measures to be adopted for the occupation of Germany after its unconditional surrender. A map attached to the document showed the division of the country between the Soviet Union, the United States, and Great Britain. It corresponded to the future delineation of the zones of occupation, with the exception of the French zone, which was introduced at the Yalta Conference. This division and the methods revealed in the Morgenthau Plan caused us to fear our future existence as a separate nation. The severity of these intentions strengthened our political opposition to the alternative of bringing a rapid end to hostilities by means of an unconditional surrender. Besides, there were other extremely important and practical considerations against adopting this course. On 12 January 1945, the Russians launched a new offensive. They penetrated into Silesia and reached the middle bank of the Oder in Christen and Frankfurt. The Wehrmacht was unable to fulfill a natural mission of protecting our peoples in the east and their territory. Terrified masses fled towards the west. They knew what the Soviet invasion meant. In October 44, having captured Gulap and several villages on the frontier of East Prussia, they massacred their inhabitants with unheard-of cruelty. An appeal to the Red Army by the Jewish writer Ilya Ehrenberg made it quite clear, quote, kill, kill, in a German race there is nothing but evil. Not one among the living, not one among the yet unborn, is they're all evil. Follow the precepts of Comrade Stalin, stamp out the fascist beast once and for all in its lair. Use force and break the racial pride of the Germanic women. Take them as your lawful booty. Kill as you storm onwards. Kill, you gallant soldiers of the Red Army. In my opinion, continued Dönitz, the first duty which befell what remained of our armed forces was to save these unfortunate people. If, to our great sorrow, we were unable to defend our lands, the very least we could do is to save their lives. If only for this reason, it was indispensable to pursue the struggle on the Eastern Front. There's another factor to consider. At the behest of the Allies, the war could only be terminated by our unconditional surrender. As far as our troops were concerned, the signature of this capitulation would immediately arrest their movements. They would have to lay down their arms and hand themselves over, whatever they might do. If we had capitulated in the winter of 44 and 45, 3.5 million soldiers who were still very far from the Anglo-American front would have been taken prisoner by the Russians. With the best will in the world, the latter would have been incapable of looking after them, feeding and sheltering them. Our men would have had to camp out in the open and in the cold, and in consequence there would certainly have been an appalling mortality. What happened in May at a much more favorable time is proof of this. Even in the West, the English and the Americans were unable to provide enough food for their prisoners, and large numbers died. There's a good book about this. I can't remember. I think I've got it in my library, but there's a delineates how many German troops died living in the just out in the countryside, digging holes to try to get out of the terrible cold. Eisenhower knew all about it. They had plenty of food, but they didn't disperse it or deliver it to these people. Eisenhower was a war criminal, just like the rest. In consequence, the termination of the war by unconditional surrender during the winter of 44-45 would have entailed the death of millions of soldiers and civilians. None of those who then held a responsible position in the Wehrmacht could urge this course of action. None of the unfortunate refugees in the East. Would have agreed to be handed over to the Russians in this way, and no soldier wanted to endure Soviet captivity. The troops probably would not have obeyed the order to stop where they were and hand themselves in. No commander could have signed the capitulation at this period without knowing that it would not be respected, and also that by doing so, he would be consigning a large number of people to their destruction. No one in conscience could take such a decision. Painful though it was to have to continue the struggle and sacrifice men on land and sea and accept the civilian losses caused by the bombing raids, nevertheless, it had to be done because their sacrifices would in the end prove to be less than those of a premature surrender of the territories in the East would have entailed. In the first days of May, Admiral Dönitz began directly negotiating with Field Marshal Montgomery with a view to concluding a partial German capitulation limited to the British-English sector on the Western Front and independently of the Russian Front. Montgomery had laid down certain conditions before it could be accepted. On 4th May, I gave Freidberg full powers to accept Montgomery's demands. He left by aeroplane for the British headquarters with instructions to continue after the convention had been signed to Reims, where General Eisenhower was stationed, in order to offer a similar partial capitulation to the Americans after his departure. We felt a burden had been taken off our shoulders. We had just taken the first step towards surrender in the West without having to agree to surrender our soldiers and civilians to the Russians. This had other consequences. Montgomery demanded the cessation of hostilities on the sea and the surrender of ships which were in the waters of Holland, Northwest Germany, Schleswig-Holstein, and Denmark. Going one step further ahead, at midday on the 4th of May, I ordered our submarines throughout the world to cease hostilities. This was part of my intention to cease hostilities against the West at the earliest possible moment. In the evening, Freidberg announced that he had signed the capitulation with Montgomery, and he was leaving to see Eisenhower. The capitulation took effect at 8 o'clock on the morning of the 5th of May. On the morning of the 6th of May, General Kinzel, who had accompanied Freidberg, arrived at Mermerwick, having been sent by Freidberg to inform me of the state of negotiations with Eisenhower. However, the latter, he told me, in contrast with Montgomery, refused to accept a partial capitulation under any conditions. We had to surrender now unconditionally and on every front, including the Russian front. The troops were to lay down their arms wherever they might be, to be taken prisoner. The high command of the Wehrmacht would be responsible for seeing that the surrender was carried out, and the order extended to all ships of war and commerce. Quote, "We were afraid that Eisenhower might adopt this attitude. In my speech on the wireless on the 1st of May, I had said, as from the moment the British and Americans are no longer fighting for their own countries, but for the extension of Bolshevism in Europe, an American station situated at Eisenhower's general headquarters had replied that this was a typical and well-known trick of the Nazis in order to create a split between Eisenhower and his Russian allies. However, the latest operations which he had ordered showed that he was not in the least aware of the turn taken by the world politics at the moment. After his troops had crossed the Rhine at Remagen, America had achieved her strategic objective of conquering Germany. From this moment, the paramount objective should have become political, namely the occupation of the largest possible area of Germany before the arrival of the Russians. Thus, it would have been judicious for American commanders to have pushed rapidly east in order to be the first to seize Berlin. But Eisenhower did not do this. He kept to the military plan which had been drawn up for the destruction of Germany in occupation in collaboration with the Red Army, and so he stopped at the Elbe. Thus, the Russians were enabled to take Berlin and conquer whatever they could in eastern Germany. Perhaps this policy had been dictated by Washington, but he did not understand how radically the world situation was to be transformed from this moment. Accordingly, I consider that this decision by the Americans was wrong, very wrong, and I have not changed my opinion today." After the Potsdam conference, an American colonel told Count Schwerin-Kroski that it was a matter of indifference to him whether the whole of Germany was occupied by the Russians, and this indeed was the attitude of all the American opinion. If I had accepted the conditions brought back by General Kinzel on the morning of 6 May, I would have had to hand over our armies in the east to the Russians immediately. I could not accept this. The troops would not have obeyed the order. A mad rout towards the west would have resulted. Thus, Eisenhower's conditions were unacceptable. All I could do was to try and convince him that I could not possibly allow our soldiers and civilians to fall into the hands of the Soviets, and accordingly I had to be content with the offering this partial capitulation. I summoned Jodl to send him to Freidenberg's help with new instructions. I wrote out a note to Jodl giving him full power to sign a general capitulation on all fronts, but he was only to use it if he was unable to obtain the first objective, which was a partial capitulation, and then only after he had informed me of the conditions and received my express agreement by cable. On 6 May, he flew to Reims. On the night of the 6th to 7th of May, I received the following message from him: "General Eisenhower insists that we must sign now today, otherwise the Allied lines will be closed against even individual persons who seek to hand themselves over, and all negotiations will be broken off. As I see it, either there is chaos or we sign. Confirm immediately by wireless that I have, in fact, got full powers to sign the capitulation. Then it can have effect. Hostilities will end on 9 May at 0 hours, German summertime. Well, I'm going to cut it off there. My eyes are wearing out. So we'll get back to this next week. Give it a break. And so I think you'll see that things are a lot different than what you were taught in school, if you were taught anything in school. 14-5.